Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Just the Facts, the podcast that features candid conversations with your favorite actors and filmmakers. I'm Alex Zane. Welcome to episode 20, featuring the brilliant Joanne Froggatt. Were you watching TV on Sunday evening? Did you see Joanne's new show, Angela Black, in which a woman in an abusive relationship discovers a dark secret about her violent husband's past? It's a powerful look at the subject of domestic violence. The reviews are already calling it a compelling and hard-hitting drama that tackles an important subject. We talk about that show and what it was like for Joanne preparing for the role. We also talk about the huge success of Downton Abbey that took her to the stage of the Golden Globes in Hollywood. And we have a right old natter bringing it back to the UK about growing up in Yorkshire and where you can find the best fish and chips in the world. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where we are at JTFpod for all the latest details on the show. And remember, you can watch this full interview on our JTFpod channel on YouTube when it is released this Friday. A quick congratulations to our listeners who correctly guessed my guest this week, Moni H, I Am Grout, Joe Frofan, Aaron Seddon, and Gemma D. Well done, all of you. Also, we got something new going on. We have a brand spanking new website, jtfpod.com. And if you head there, like right now or soon, you can subscribe to our newsletter to get all the latest info on the pod, any live shows we've got coming up, and, you know, just become part of our growing Just the Facts family. If you do like the show and enjoy this interview, please do take the time to rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It is a massive help, and we'd love you to do that. That'd be lovely of you. Please do that. Thank you. Right, shall we get into this? Please welcome to Just the Facts, the wonderful Joanne Froggatt.
Brilliant. I've hit record, so we're doing this now. It's happening. It's happening. How are you, Joanne?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm really good. How are you?
Yes. Do you know what? I'm pretty good. Thank you for asking. I'm in London, and you are. Where are you in the world right now?
I'm in Yorkshire at the moment, at my parents' house. Yeah. So I'm in the middle of the North Yorkshire moors right now.
So in not too stalkery a way, I did a little bit of research, obviously, you know, as a professional. And
Your job.
It is my job. In fact, you'd be embarrassed if I hadn't done this research. But we grew up not too far from each other because I'm from Leeds originally. And you're not far. You're sort of between Leeds and where I spent a lot of time as a child, Whitby area and Robin Hood's Bay.
Yeah, I didn't know you were from Leeds.
Yep. Leeds, born and bred. Although weirdly, I think last year, no, a couple of years ago, I've now spent longer in London than I have in Leeds. It's London's home for you, though, isn't it? You're just visiting up there.
Yeah. Same as me. I haven't actually lived full time in Yorkshire since I was 13. So quite a long time. I've moved around quite a bit, and then I've been south for a long time, 15 years and a few years in between. So yeah, all over.
Is it nice going home though?
It's lovely. It's so nice. My parents' place is, like I say, sort of literally in the middle of the North Yorkshire moors as well. You can't see another house from their house. So it's really lovely. It's really kind of calm and peaceful. I'm just amazed that, obviously, I grew up in this house, but it never ceases to amaze me that every time I go to sleep here as an adult, I can't hear anything. There's just nothing, no noise. And I'm like, oh my goodness, yeah. It's just like, there's no one out there.
That doesn't surprise me. I may have done before, but I'm just unaware of it. But the place your parents live is actually described on the internet as a hamlet. You grew up in a hamlet.
I did. It's not even a village. It's not even big enough to be named a village. We're tiny, tiny, tiny hamlet. It's even a small hamlet, to be fair. So yeah, I don't really know what that makes us. Just a collection of houses spread out over a very large space.
Do you still have friends up there, though? Is it like, because when I go back to Leeds, unfortunately, a lot of my friends have moved away, but there are still some key people from my childhood who I'm like, oh my God, it's nice to see you again. And it is that sort of massive hit of nostalgia in terms of who you grew up with and where you hung out as a kid. Do you have that?
Yeah, a couple of people. I mean, I went to stage school down south in Maidenhead in Berkshire when I was 13. So a lot of my close friends that I still have from school are from that school, from, you know, from sort of age 13 onwards. So, but I do have a couple of close friends still in the Whitby area that I always check in with when I'm home. And it's that thing, isn't it? It's so nice because when people have known you sort of all your life, it just makes you feel really grounded, and it just kind of cuts through everything else. And it's just the two of you there again. And it's just like it always has been. So nothing really beats that.
Yeah, I get that. I think is it the final line of Stand By Me, the film where it's like, you never have friends like you had when you were 12 years old. And I remember hearing that and going, that's so true.
I love that. That movie, and it is so true. It's so true. Yeah, absolutely.
And also growing up near Whitby, you must have been, you were spoilt for fish and chips. That's what I remember about being a kid and going to Whitby. It was just some of the best fish and chips I'd ever eaten.
I mean, I am a little bit biased, but I think they may be the best fish and chips in the world. I don't want to cause, you know, an argument about this, but, you know, I think. In my opinion, they're the best in the world. I had them this week. It's one thing I do have to do every time I come home. I do have to have fish and chips at least once. Yeah.
And you mentioned sort of like 13, like going to theatre school at 13, which is like it seems like a young age. But before we get to that part, you must have realised, but at what point did you realise then that you wanted to act? Because you must have been quite set that, look, this is what I want to do at a surprisingly young age.
Yeah, it's It's all I ever can remember wanting to do, really. I just used to watch a lot of movies with my brother, who's 4 years older than me, and, you know, when I was really, really little. And I just always wanted to be on the telly having all these adventures. I didn't even really know what it was at the time, but even from the age of sort of four, I used to stand in front of the television and pretend I was on television and think my brother would believe that I was actually on the TV. I wasn't a smart child, but there you go. But he was older, so I just had this sort of fascination with this place inside this box where you could go to all these different worlds and times and have all these crazy adventures. And I knew they weren't all real, but I was too young to sort of process what that was and that you could do that as a job. So I always had this sort of fascination with it. And then, as I sort of grew up and realized you could do that as a job, I thought, well, that's what I want to do. I want to do that and live all these different lives and, you know, be all these different people.
And that was, so we were children at roughly the same time. So that would have been the 80s, movies that were released in the 80s, a great decade for cinema.
Great decade for cinema. I totally agree. Yeah.
Were there movies from that period that stick in your mind even now? Because one that I remember distinctly, and this is because it was on TV in the 80s, not because it was an 80s film, but by the time I got to watch it on TV, it had been out a few years, which is Jaws. And I'm still to this day surprised that I was allowed to watch it by my mum. But it is the reason that I'm sitting here interviewing you, because it's the reason I love, you know, the medium of film and TV, and like this experience of watching it late night, I think it was on ITV, just stuck with me because it horrified me. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, well, the same with me, and because my brother's 4 years older than me, and you know, we grew up on a farm. My parents had their own business before moving to the farm, so my parents always worked from home, so they were always around. But my brother was stuck with kind of keeping an eye on the younger sister a lot of the time while mum and dad worked, so they were there but they were busy. So, you know, that's why we'd watch so many movies, and I watched a lot of slightly inappropriate movies for my age because my brother was eight and I was sort of four. So yeah, Jaws, oh god, I still look over my shoulder every time I'm in a swimming pool on my own. I mean,
yeah. Oh, I get you.
I'm still like, oh, is anything there? No, I'm fine. Jaws, Gremlins, oh, like that movie, I still watch it every Christmas. And then my brother was massively into Tom Cruise, which I was as well. So Top Gun, I must have seen about 500 times, Cocktail, all of those kind of movies as well. Stand By Me, another one. Pretty Woman, although I had to hide that from my parents because I wasn't allowed to watch that. So
why? Because she played a sex worker, or because it was a little bit naughty?
Because she played a sex worker.
Right.
But they were quite happy to let me watch American Werewolf in London. So that was apparently fun. So there we go. Great parenting skills, mum and dad. Thanks.
It's weird, isn't it? You sort of go, I think a lot of parents are like that. It's like absolutely nothing that is anywhere related to sex. But if, you know, someone gets torn to shreds by a werewolf and you see it as well on screen, that's fine, because it's horror is okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's not going to harm your ethics.
So was there a performance you saw in one of these films? Or was it just a general experience of watching films that made you go, this is the moment where I go from just enjoying performing in front of the TV to actually going, I want to actually make something like this?
There was actually, again, another film which was inappropriate for my age to be watching. I was about 8 years old, and I was at my grandparents' house, my mum's mum and dad in near Sheffield, staying for the holidays. And Whatever Happened to Baby Jane was on.
Oh, wow.
My grandma recorded it, and she said, oh, this is a fantastic movie, we must watch this movie. And so we watched it, and because she'd recorded it on VHS, that's how long it was, I was just mesmerized by these two, you know, horrific female characters that were just kind of, well, horrific to each other. And this, I'd never, because the movies I'd watched before had, you know, the Slipper and the Rose, a version of Cinderella, like all, you know, all the 80s stuff or whatever. It was all kind of quite fantasy and stuff. And this was real, really kind of like visceral nastiness between these two women. And I just became obsessed with it. And my whole stay there for the next 2 weeks, I watched it every day for 2 weeks. And I was just like sat in front of the TV with my mouth open, like every day going, wow, what is this? And I wonder if I can do this. Like, and that's definitely a moment that I remember, or a film that was pivotal in me kind of seeing a performance for the first time, or kind of maybe starting to understand what a performance was and how you could really have fun being all these, you know, different characters, whether they be nice or not. And I'd also not seen women behave badly like that before in terms of my reference point, because I was a child. And I was like, oh, this is much more interesting than the Cinderella story.
Wow. I mean, that's an amazing movie to set you on this career path, because it's not what you'd expect at all. I would not have guessed that. If you did, I could not have put money on it being Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Amazing. So you saw that, and then you know, was it a case of, you know, as soon as you could, you wanted to, you know, for want of a better cliche, go out and see the bright lights of the big city and be in a location where you could explore that? Because again, 13 seems like quite a young age to sort of up sticks. I'm assuming it was a boarding school that you were studying at.
It wasn't a boarding school, but I boarded with a woman who worked for the school, because it was like a 5-hour drive from where my parents are, or where I lived at the time. So it kind of just came about sort of as a snowball effect, really, because I started secondary school when I was 11, and the head teacher at my secondary school in Whitby, David Bradley, was really into drama, and he started an out of school drama group, which I started to go to, called Rounders. And there was an affiliation between that and the theatre in the Round, Alan Ayckbourn's theatre in Scarborough. So we did drama group, which I loved. And then through doing that, I think our drama teacher mentioned the Stage newspaper one day, which I heard had auditions in it. So in my 11-year-old brain, I was like, I'm going to get the Stage. I'm going to get this audition. I'm going to be a big movie star or whatever. And so my parents ordered it for me from the local news agent. So they used to order it in for me every month. And I'm sure they were quite embarrassed about that, but anyway, they did. And then when I was looking through the Stage, there are auditions, but a lot of them were sort of dancers on cruise ships, or, you know, not really appropriate for somebody of 11. But in there I saw adverts for Stage schools, and I just, my eyes sort of popped open, and I was like, wow, that's it, that's what I want to do. And obviously I had visions of fame and everything else in my head, and I'd been, you know, dancing around on leg warmers and whatever. And so I said to my parents, this is what I want to go to Stage school, this is what I want to do. And I think because they knew I was quite single-minded, they didn't want to say no, because they thought it would make me more determined to do it. So they just said, okay, fine, well, we're not helping you, but you carry on with it then, if that's what you want to do. So I did, and I wrote off to quite a few, I think very off to 6 Stage schools, and just wrote, you know, a letter, and got prospectuses from them all, and I read through them. And Red Roofs Theatre School, which is the one I went to, was the one that sounded a little bit more homely and sort of friendly in their sort of information pack. And so I said to my parents, I want to go to this one. And they said, okay, well, carry on. And so I wrote off, and then I got in. And then I got in when I, you know, I got offered a place at the school. And then my parents were like, oh God, now what are we going to do? Because it's, you know, there's school fees and there's boarding fees, and they couldn't afford to pay for both. So then I started on a process of, which my parents did step in at that point and help me along the way. And me and my dad wrote letters to the local council, and they didn't have grants for people my age, which was sort of 12 at the time, because why would you? We went back and forth with them for a few months. And then in the end, I auditioned for the council, and they created a grant for me, which covered the school fees. And then my parents covered the boarding fees. So the whole process from me having the first idea to actually getting to the school took just over 2 years. And then I actually got there when I was 13.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like, you know, it's incredible that you were that determined at what, age 11, to go, look, even if you're not going to help me, mum, dad, I'm going to write these letters myself. I'm going to find out everything. We're going to get the prospectuses. It sounds like you were prepared for the career that lies ahead, because you often, as someone who isn't an actor, you do often hear about the necessary self-belief and commitment to it, and to take the hard knocks that come with rejection and then just get back on your feet and audition again. It sounds like you kind of had that mindset built in from a very young age.
I mean, I guess so. Maybe I think it was just maybe just part of my personality naturally, but my parents always brought me and my brother up to, you know, to have a go at things in life. My parents had very different careers all through their lives. You know, it was my dad's dream to have a small holding and move to a farm one day, which we did, and all their friends and family thought they were absolutely crackers for doing that. So you know, they just said, it's your life, you have to live it. So I just was always brought up with that sort of mindset. So I just thought, well, why can't I, you know, which in hindsight was a really great thing my parents instilled in me, because the sort of, well, if that person can, why can't I? It's actually, you know, really good sort of mindset to have. But I wasn't aware of it at the time, I guess.
No, it's brilliant. Because I mean, I guess the other angle is, you know, you get the whole Billy Elliot kind of thing where they're like, no, Joanne, we're farmers. You're going to be a farmer too, like us.
You're going to milk the sheep and you're going to like it.
Yeah. So Red Roof's Theatre School. I'm right in thinking this. It's quite along with yourself. There's some fair few talented alumni that came out of that school. There's like I said yourself, Chris Marshall, I think, was there. Kate Winslet, I think I'm right in thinking that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I didn't. Neither of them were there when I was there, but we all went. We all went there. Yeah.
And was it kind of fun then, being at this school at that age, at age 13? Was it sort of like an enjoyable thing to be around people? Because I think it's quite rare. Normally when you're 13, I think most people would be, you know, comprehensive school or whatever kind of school, but they'd be around people with diverse interests. Was it more fun to be around people who all had the same kind of dream? Or was it kind of a little bit competitive because you all kind of knew at some point you might end up going for the same jobs, or, you know, you were trying for the same success in the same field?
Yeah, well, I mean, my experience of it was just wonderful. I know, you know, really like with any situation or school or place of education or place of work, it really depends on the people that you end up with, which often you don't have any control over. So there was only seven of us in our class, and I'm still best friends with all of them today, and a couple of the girls that were in the class below, one girl I lived with, and they're like my second family. And we were just this maybe this real sort of hodgepodge of kids, really. And I guess because we were such a small group and we were in our teenage years, we were all very different personalities and actually all wanted to do different things in the industry. Sort of, I guess half the class wanted to be dancers. A couple of the girls were very much had amazing vocals and wanted to go into musical theatre or singing as a career. And I think I was actually the only one who wanted to do just acting. I mean, I'm practically tone deaf, so the singing was definitely out. dancing, you know, I can kind of do it, but I loved doing dance classes, but I was never good enough to be professional, and it was always acting I wanted to do. So yeah, it was a kind of like, it was a great time actually, because I worked, I think, so much harder than I possibly would have done at a normal comprehensive, because we used to do our academic lessons in the morning and our vocational lessons in the afternoon. So we had less time on the academic and more homework. But I knew what sacrifices my parents were making to give me the opportunity, I worked my little socks off. And, you know, I worked hard at school. I always spent so much time on my homework. I still got really good GCSEs, even though we're only doing sort of half the school day on academics. And I just really wanted to be there, you know, I just really, really, and I loved it. So my experience of it, me and my friends always say to each other how lucky we are that we've got this, you know, this tight friendship group that we've known each other for, dare I say it, 27 years now. And we just, you know, there's not, that doesn't happen very often. And I think it was because we were such a small class. I think if we were in a class of like 30, you know, or in a year of 100 kids in separate classes, maybe we wouldn't have all been friends because we actually were quite different personalities. But because we were all sort of lumped together, we really formed strong bonds, which was great.
And going on from theatre school, do you remember the first TV gig you landed? Like, as in, was that, I guess, the "we want you for this," like a big moment in your career? Or was it just sort of part and parcel of the journey that you were on?
No, absolutely was a big moment. Not necessarily for my, well, it was the start, actually. It did snowball into the next job and everything else. But I was still at stage school, and I remember it so well. I auditioned and got a role in one episode of The Bill. And I was playing an underage sex worker in the episode. And I remember calling my parents. Like, I was over the moon. It was a big deal, do you know what I mean? Because like lots of the kids got adverts and bits and pieces, and I hadn't ever got, I'd been on auditions with the school because there was an agency alongside, and I'd never sort of landed a little advert or anything. And I was always a bit like, I never seem to. And then I got sort of a proper acting role, but in my head it was just, you know, unbelievable. I remember going to the phone box. God, I'm really showing my age now. Going to the phone box, calling my parents, and was like, "Oh my God, guess what? I'm going to be an underage sex worker in the film." they were like, "We're so proud of you. This is what you've been working for."
we wish we'd let you watch Pretty Woman. We should have let you watch Pretty Woman. It would have been research. Wow.
Exactly.
Wow.
But it was, God, over the moon with it. Yeah.
That's amazing. I imagine it's always a big moment, and that first role you land. I mean, sort of to bring us more up to speed, because obviously I want to talk to you about Angela Black. But before we get to that, I mean, I think it's fair to say one of the roles that you're very well known for was because it was a phenomenal series. But it was also a role within that series that I think audiences really fell in love with. So I'm obviously talking about Downton Abbey, but I do think Anna, your character, was something of a breakout star from that series, in so much as people really loved her and her story.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Oh, thank you. I loved playing her. I think what was special about Anna was her relationship with Mr. Bates, as in I think it was Anna and Bates together that people fell in love with. And me and Brendan were so pleasantly surprised by how much people got on board with their relationship from the off, because it was very much when the series first started, it was very much the sort of Mary and Matthew upstairs and sort of Anna and Bates downstairs. So we felt we were the sort of less glamorous sort of couple, you know, downstairs, because we're playing the servants. So we didn't expect people to sort of get on board with their sort of, you know, with their relationship and their trials and tribulations as much as they did. But I think people really connected with Anna and Bates' relationship as this sort of slow burn. Both characters had such strong moral codes and such strong values. And in that way, that's actually, you know, quite a rare thing, as we all know. And so in that way, they were just so perfect for each other. And they came across so many obstacles that needed to be overcome. I think, you know, the audiences just kept rooting for them, and it was sort of their love grew from this real respect for each other and this sort of friendship. And, you know, they couldn't be together, and then you're like, please be together. And so it was just wonderful to see how people got behind them, and Anna as a character as well, and obviously everything that she went through. And when I first got the role, I just loved Anna, and I really wanted to play her. And at that point, it was the sort of character that I'd not really played before, because she was just kind of, you know, a really good person and really lovely, and the kind of person you would want as a best friend, you know, that she'd be so loyal and she'd always have your back. And so I wanted to find like a real strength to her as well, because actually I think it does take a real strength to be able to be that kind of person. I think in some ways you have to be a much stronger person than if you're going to follow the crowd, or, you know, or kind of, you know, maybe not have such a strict moral code. So I didn't want her to be this sort of saccharine, sweet, wishy-washy person. I wanted her to have like a strength of character. So I was so pleased when people connected with her, because I kind of fell in love with her a little bit. She's definitely someone I'd have as a friend.
And do correct me if I'm wrong, but the three Emmy nominations and one Golden Globe win for your performance as Anna, that's kind of a big deal. How much of a big deal was it for you? Is it just window dressing, or is it actually like, freaking hell, I've won a Golden Globe?
It was a huge deal. It was an absolutely huge deal. And it's bizarre, because as I say, it's not something you think about on a day-to-day basis. Like, none of us do we? We don't sit here and think about our achievements or the things we've done wrong in life. You just kind of hopefully looking at today and tomorrow and moving forward. But whenever I sort of stop to talk about it, it does bring back all those emotions of just kind of, wow. I remember the first year that Downton was nominated at the Emmys, and Michelle Dockery and myself went over for the week, and we sort of cadged the extra tickets, and we went as the producer and the directors plus ones, because we kind of like planned it between us. We were like, should we go? Michelle's auntie and Trish, I'll give her a name check, lives in LA, and she said, we can stay with Aunt Trish, let's go. And I was like let's do it. So we flew ourselves over, we did our own hair and makeup and stuff. We got hair and makeup for the actual big Emmy event, but all the pre-parties, we borrowed clothes, we switched clothes with each other, we just totally went for it. And I remember we had an absolute blast, like going to all these kind of events that we hadn't had any of those kind of experiences before, those big American award shows. And I remember us both sitting there in the audience, really far back with our team, and lovely Elizabeth McGovern was nominated for performance that first year. So she was down the front. And I remember me and Michelle looking at each other and me saying, Oh my goodness, imagine what Elizabeth must be feeling right now. She must have her heart in her mouth. How amazing would that be to be personally nominated by Heart? And then cut to the following year, me and Michelle both have personal nominations as well. And so we just couldn't believe our luck, you know, but nothing, we always say nothing will quite match that first experience when we were there, sort of not quite feeling like we had the, like we should be yet, you know. And then being able to go back the following year and just be like, wow, we're here again, but this time it's official, you know. And they were magical times. They really were. They were magical experiences. And I think it happened at a time in my life and a time in my career where I'd been working for 12 years before I did Downton. And I was really glad it came when it did, because I was at a mindset about things where I thought, wow, I must make sure I enjoy these moments. I must make the most of them. Like I must take all this in and just enjoy it, because it may never happen again. And what an incredible experience to have in your life. And the actual Golden Globe win was just, I mean, it was just a fairy tale. I still, when I talk about it, I still just remember this hit of kind of adrenaline of and they sort of say my name and I'm clapping away thinking they said someone else's name. And then it sort of dawns on me that it was my name. And I mean, for once in my life, I was lost for words. And I just thought, I've got to go to the stage. And that was it. And then I came off stage and I was just, it was possibly the most surreal moment of my life, but one of the most magical. And yeah, it was just a fairy tale.
Because I've covered both the Globes and the Oscars for Sky over the years, and I just always wonder what are you seeing? The crowd, are the lights too bright? Can you see faces of people who you like grew up watching you? Then there you are, and I'm on stage, and is it kind of just like a blur?
No, you can see everyone. So you walk past, and also where we were, because the TV sort of awards tables are always further back than the movie ones, because obviously like you've got your A-list of movie stars at the front and they're sort of more on camera for the ceremony. So you have to, you know, from our table, from the dance table, I had to walk through it. Like it felt like it took me 10 years to get to the stage, and I'm walking past like everybody I've ever seen in every movie, just thinking, this isn't happening. This is happening. This is actually happening. And you have to stand up there and you have to speak, hopefully eloquently. And it's not like being in the theatre where, you know, the audience are in darkness. You can see everybody. And it was the most surreal and wonderful experience. And you know what? Everyone was so kind and lovely and encouraging, and, you know, met lots of people before and afterwards who were just so, yeah, just so encouraging and friendly, and made it it felt like a really warm room to be in. I do have to say.
Because it was already a success in the States at that point. It sort of landed big in the US.
Yeah. By that point, it was sort of we were a fully fledged success in the US by season four. Yeah.
And when it came to an end and you sort of look back along that journey, I guess, did you know when the series ended, when the sixth series came to an end, were you aware at that point that there was the potential for a movie, or had it been like, or did you think this is it? I'm saying goodbye to this huge part of my life.
We did know that they being the producers and Julian Fellowes, our writer, we did know that they wanted to, they hoped that a movie could happen. Excuse me, taking a drink of water. But we weren't sure. You never are in this business. You don't know what's happening from one minute to the next. So, but we knew there was the intention of that, which was great. And I think everybody was absolutely on board for that. I think the show as a series, I think we finished at the right time. I feel like, you know, we left on a high still, which is where you want to be. You don't want to sort of keep going and going and going until it sort of loses all its quality. So I think it was sort of a perfect choice, really. So we had that, you know, 2 or 3 years in between finishing filming the series and starting to shoot the first movie. And again, who could have known the first movie would have been such a success? I mean, obviously we knew that the audience would be fans of the show. So there's a big fan base, and that should be great. But I mean, the movie surpassed everybody's expectations, that because it's that thing of like, well, people love watching it when it's on TV, but are they going to bother to leave their homes and get in a car and go to the cinema and pay for their ticket and do all of that? And my goodness, they did in their droves. So that was so incredible. It just was like, wow, what a joy that was to sort of be a part of that as well. It's sort of one of the biggest movies of the year, and the biggest movie focused features that's ever produced, and all biggest box office in terms of revenue. And I mean, we were just like, wow, it's, you know, they've managed to do it again.
it's wonderful to see something that, you know, is a staple of Sunday night drama, and then it was pushing £200 million at the box office, something incredible like that.
Yeah, it was just over 200 million, I think, at the box office, which is crazy, isn't it? It's crazy, but fantastic. Thank you, everyone, that wants to see it.
Yes, and enough success. I mean, I'm sure when the accountants are counting the dollars that have rolled in, they're already going, so the sequel. And sure enough, we are getting a sequel. The new era, Downton Abbey, the new era. Am I right in thinking that? That's what I think it's called. Out next year. Have you finished shooting it? I don't want to pressure you into saying something and having old fellows on the phone going, what have you said? But I would love to know where you are with it.
Yes, we have. We've finished shooting. It's going to be out in March time, I think. Obviously, I can't tell you anything about it, but there is, wondering what I can say without saying, giving too much away and getting into trouble. There is a visit to the house, which causes a lot of excitement, I would say, and some unsettlement. And there is a trip abroad, ... watch this space. That's all I can say.
That'll do me. No, I'm excited for it. I'm a fan. I mean, I remember it was Julian Fellowes and his writing that actually got me into period dramas, because I was a bit sniffy about it, because, you know, I grew up watching sci-fi and horror, and I'm like, oh, period dramas. And then it was actually the script he won the Oscar for, Gosford Park, the Robert Altman movie that I ended up watching and going, okay, this is a period drama, and I'm into it in a big way.
Yeah, it's such a fantastic movie. And that's where, you know, I'm sure it's obvious, but that's where Downton came from. Gareth Neame, our exec producer, approached Julian and said, what do you feel about doing Gosford Park for television, basically? And I think Julian was like, oh, not really thought about that. And that's literally how Downton was born. So.
Well, that makes sense. I'm a fan of both. But let's talk now about your new series. I think I'm okay to say it's coming out in October. I'm going to leave it at that for the moment. When I introduce you at the top of the show and I record that, I'm sure they'll have a firm date. But I'm just going to roll the dice with October right now. And it's called Angela
it's
Black.
October, yeah.
It is October. Yeah.
Yes, I can confirm it's October.
Great stuff. So backstory wise, this is created by the same team that you worked with on Liar, Harry and Jack Williams. And that was a huge hit, Liar. I did my due diligence. The figures for Liar, like sort of around 9 million. That's incredible in this day and age of, you know, streaming services, all the what have yous, you know, and suddenly you're looking at a viewership of that. That's pretty cool, huh?
It was, it was incredible. It was just, again, that was, well, you can never expect these things. I thought it was, you know, I knew it was going to be a really great show, but we were all so thrilled when people connected with it as they did. And, you know, that's really down to Jack and Harry's writing, and they write thrillers and drama so well, but they write these sort of cliffhanger moments and edge of your seat stuff, but also, you know, ground their shows in something sort of deeper, or certainly, you know, certainly the ones that I've done with them. And there's often an underlying subject matter, got a sort of through note through the whole thing. So, you know, first and foremost, it's a piece of entertainment, but I love the way they almost bury a really important subject matter in there. So people are sort of connecting with it without even realizing. Mm. And I just find that really impressive that they can do that. And I'm not sure how they do, but they do.
Kind of like a Trojan horse of a series. You're sort of buying into it because you're like, oh, great, I'll watch a thriller. But actually, there's quite an important message buried within it.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously with Lyre, it was, you know, the issue of consent and sexual assault and the sort of lack of... the lack of conviction rates. And yeah, but for, as I say, first and foremost, it's a brilliant thriller, and they've gone and done it again with Angela Black, in my opinion. I read the first three episodes and I just could not put it down. And so Angela Black is a thriller with, you know, based on the topic of domestic abuse, or based around that subject matter. Mm. It stems from that situation. But it's a very different beast to Lyre in every way. The character is very, very different. The sort of the way the story moves is very different. Lyre was very much sort of this one big catalyst event that happens at the beginning, and then things spiral from there. Whereas for Angela and Laura, my character in Lyre, very much had a voice, knew her voice, was used to being listened to, was used to being respected. And, you know, was this anger came up inside her because she for the first time in her life probably found herself not being listened to, not being believed, not being respected, not being understood. Whereas Angela is a very different character in terms of we meet her when she's still trying to find her voice, and she's still trying to find that fight in her. And from the outside, she looks like she has the most perfect life, you know, handsome husband, gorgeous home, two beautiful children, volunteers in a dog's home, nice clothes, nice car, or, you know, the whole package. But obviously what's going on behind closed doors is very, very different. And then she meets a private investigator who gives her some more information about her husband, who she knows to be a dangerous man, and things spiral from there. So she sort of finds out one bit of information, then another bit, then another bit. So it's a much more sort of Hitchcockian style kind of unraveling, which I loved. And our director, Craig Viveras, did an incredible job at really pulling that out and, you know, giving it a real, making it look kind of cool as well, you know, from an aesthetic point of view. So yeah, I'm really excited about it. I can't wait for people to see it and see how they react to it.
It does look cool. And for the record, I've seen it. Someone very kindly sent me just the first episode. So if you do want to pass on scripts 2 and 3, I'm happy to read them, because it's one of those things that comes with the territory of this job. I'm just like, man, I've watched one episode and now I'm like, come on, when do I get to watch episode 2? October? That's not fair, because it is one of those shows that you immediately go, but no, I need more. I need this story to continue immediately. But I'd love to know what your reaction was when you read the script. So you sent the first three episodes, and I imagine it comes with a question at that point. Do you want to play this character? Are you interested, having read the script, in playing her?
Yeah, exactly. So I was fortunate enough, obviously, that I've worked with Jack and Harry before. And so they'd written the first three episodes of Angela Black, and they sent them to me to read for interest, and said, you know, we'd love you to play Angela if it's something you'd be interested in. And as I said, I started reading and I just couldn't stop. I mean, I think I'm pretty sure I read all three back to back, just in one sitting, which I don't usually do. Mm. So I just I just wanted to know what happens next. And the story I can't say anything because there's so much, you know, it has to unravel, but my goodness, it just goes, the story really just flies, and you just go, I mean, the twists and turns in it are incredible and kept me guessing. And I was sat there going, no, no. And I'm literally kind of vocalizing my reaction, sat on my own reading the script. And I thought, okay, this must be good because I'm actually talking to myself. So so that was it. I was like, yes, yes, please. Yes, I'd love to play her. Thank you very much.
and so when you get a script, what is it that you're looking for in a script that puts it on the yes pile or the interested pile, let's say, compared to it going on the no, absolutely not pile? And are there things in it that you are keen to do? Because like the example you just used between Laura in Liar and Angela in Angela Black is the fact that you're dealing on the one hand with a character who has a voice and a character who has yet to find her voice. And is it that difference that makes a role exciting to you? Because you're like, this is very different to what I've just done. So it includes in it really new, interesting challenges for me as an actor.
Yeah, it's exactly that, really. I mean, first and foremost, it always comes down to if it's a page turner. You know, I think you usually know by the first 10 pages if something's hooked you in, you know, and if it hasn't by then, I always read the full script, but you kind of know it's not going to, you know. But then also there's other things to consider. So it's, you know, the team behind it, who's going to be directing it. But first and foremost, it comes down to the script, the story. And also, is it exactly that? Is it a character I really want to play? Is it something I've not done before? Is it something I've not done for a while? Is it just something completely fresh and new? And I love the versatility of my job, and that's what keeps it interesting for me. I love doing different things and different characters, and that's what I find really fun about it, and sort of creating these different, you know, characters and personalities and stuff. So it's very much that. And when I took on Angela Black, I mean, I didn't have any concerns about any similarities to Liar, actually, because the script and the character were written so differently. But I also said, like, I need to look different, I need to this, you know, there's lots, and also I needed to build a very, very different kind of character. And I feel like we managed to do that without anyone, I don't think anyone's going to sit there and go, oh, that's the same actress that's worked with those same writers. I'm hoping that doesn't, you know, cross over, which I'm sure it won't.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, as you've mentioned already, it's powerful stuff. I mean, the opening is not easy to watch, which you'd imagine in a series that deals with domestic abuse. It shouldn't be easy to watch, but it is. It's powerful stuff. Mikael Huisman, I believe it's pronounced, I hope I haven't got that wrong. He plays your husband in it, who, you know, I recognize from Game of Thrones. I'm sure a lot of people will. What's it like working with him? First of all, as sort of as a co-star in something like this, but I guess also when you're dealing with subject matter like this, because it's a terrifying performance he gives, and as it should be. But is there a different skill set that comes with approaching something that is as intense as the relationship that you have with him?
Yeah, I mean, Mikael was just brilliant. He's just a really lovely guy and really easy to work with. And we both, I think we both came into this really passionate about the project, and Mikael really wanted to play the role because he often doesn't get to play the, you know, in crude terms, the bad guy, you know. But psychologically, it's a really kind of interesting thing to take on as an actor. So he was really passionate about doing this, and there was a lot of, you know, back and forth with dates, and we all had to really make it work, and he himself had to sort of be away from the family a bit longer than he'd wanted to and bring the family over, and there was lots of cogs happening, turning to make it possible that he could come and play the role. So we were all thrilled when it worked out, and we both just, which is always makes life easy, we both just had the same mindset. You know, I think when you're taking on a project that is, you know, that has got a sensitive subject matter at the heart of it, it just means we all have, or I certainly feel, an extra responsibility to do the best job I can. And Mikael absolutely felt the same. And we really wanted to get, you know, we'd both done a lot of research, and we really wanted to get their relationship feeling really real, and this sort of power play between the two of them that after, you know, we Women's Aid were really fantastic and helped not only Jack and Harry in during the script process, the script writing process, but also McKeel and I during our research process. And one of the counsellors and advisors that we spoke to said that there's often this sort of power shift between an abusive relationship. So say in our case, the man's the abuser, the woman's the abused. So the abused is abused. And then the abuser then goes into the sort of cycle of the sorry and the trying to make up for it. And then the abuse sort of feels like they have the upper hand for a really short space of time, although they never really do, but psychologically it feels like they do. And then when they accept the abuser back into the relationship, the whole cycle kind of starts all over again. And it's just this. And so we wanted to sort of, you know, weave that into the relationship. And we wanted to make both the characters obviously as three-dimensional as possible and have those moments where hopefully you could see, oh God, if only he wasn't abusive, they could have been really happy together, you know? Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, as crude to say it, but the moments of charm and everything, because nobody falls for somebody because they're horrible to them all the time. Nobody falls for somebody because they abuse them constantly. You know, you fall for somebody because that behavior develops over a time once the feelings and the love has been built. So, you know, we wanted to really try and weave that in underneath, you know, the scenes we were playing together. And so hopefully we did that.
I mean, based on the first episode alone, I think you did. There's a couple of very big moments in there. I think you said it earlier, like real, like, what moments? And that's just the first episode. So yeah, I'm excited to see the rest of Angela Black. While I've got you, I do want to ask you about another movie that you were in, just because it's. I remember giving this movie 5 stars when it came out, because I've never been smacked around the face quite as much by a cinematic experience. And that's director John Bird's movie, Filth.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that when you said smack around the face by a movie. Absolutely. That's a great way to describe it. Yeah, I loved that experience. It was so good. I mean, you know, I only played a small role in Filth, but John S. Baird is, you know, super talented director. I love his vision. Super down-to-earth guy as well. Just a great, great guy to work with. And James McAvoy, I mean, he's just that. I mean, he is just he's outstanding in everything, but I mean, Filth, he blows my mind. And working with him on set, and again, James is one of the most loveliest guys you'll ever work with, just such a great human. And I remember being on set with him on that movie, and he had to do some, you know, as you know, some really like extreme shifts of emotion. Oh, yeah. And there were some scenes where he had to be really upset and stuff. And there was a scene we did in the supermarket, and my character bumps into him with her child, and he's really in pieces, and she's sort of saying, are you okay? And he's very much not okay. And we were just waiting to go on set, and, you know, sat around the corner and having a chat about whatever the day. And then he's like, oh yeah, cool. So then we go on set, and he just literally like flips a switch, and this emotion just comes out of him. And I was like, I mean, it just made my job really easy because I was just reacting to him. And I was just like, wow. I said to him after, I was like, James, how do you do that so easily? He's so sort of emotionally available. I was just like, that was impressive. That was impressive. So yeah, it was such a great experience. I love Irvine Welsh as well. So for me to be in a movie based on one of his novels was a bit of a dream come true, I have to say. And John S. Baird is, yeah, he's just one of the, I think he's one of our brightest talents, really.
Yeah, he's, I met him at the Stan and Ollie premiere, and that's such a tender, sweet movie. And I was like, oh my God, the last time we spoke, you just directed Filth, and it's just weird putting this movie and that movie next to each other as your work. But yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's very also very versatile.
yes, I definitely agree with that. So The one thing that I wanted to say before I say goodbye is thank you, I think, really. Oh, no, that was it. I just remembered it while I was riffing there. I was like, there was something I was just going to say. Did you and James exchange war stories? Because I think both your debut TV appearances were on the bill. His first TV appearance was on the bill, and I think so was yours.
I didn't know James's first role was on the bill. We actually worked together when I was, we must have both, I think James is around the same age as me. I think I was 21. We did a show called Lorna Doone together. Well, we did an adaptation of Lorna Doone on BBC. And that was, James is not long out of drama school, I think. And that was like sort of a very early on. I think it was, one of his first jobs, and obviously not the first. But I didn't know he did the bill. I have to ask you about that next time we bump into each other.
Yes, we should do this again sometime. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I think the last time we saw each other was 2016, A Street Cat Named Bob, the premiere of Hers and Mayfair. Was that it?
That's right. It would have been. Yeah, absolutely. Long time, it feels like. A long time.
Doesn't it? I mean, everything that has happened between then and now, it feels like, a decade ago, sort of even being at a premiere with crowds like pouring over the barriers and all the rest of it. It seems like a long time ago.
It really just feels like a different world, doesn't it? Absolutely. Yeah. But thanks for having me on, Alex.
An absolute pleasure, Joanne. And thank you again. And good luck with Angela Black. It looks like it's going to be another big hit.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Fingers crossed.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.